Welcome to the Inside Out Money Podcast.
Can't even recognize this place. Too many pieces of our past mistakes.
Hi, I'm Maggie, and I believe real change starts from the inside out. So let's work together to improve our money and our lives from the inside out. We will explore all things money and our relationship with it. Join me each week with a rotating set of co-hosts, friends, and interviews. Let's jump in. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Maggie.
How are you?
Good.
Welcome to Inside Out Money.
Thank you. I am super excited about this.
I am really excited about this too, Andrew. So this is Andrew Knight, for those who, you have a good name. You have like a Batman style name, Andrew. Andrew Knight. You could call him AK if you want. He is one of our new Inside Out Money rotating co-hosts. I don't know the right term for that, but we're going to roll with rotating co-hosts for now.
I think that works.
Yeah. And I'm excited because I'm going to give a little Andrew backstory. And then Andrew, I'm going to let you introduce yourself. But since this is our first episode together, I thought it'd be helpful for all of our listeners to hear a little bit about you. And then we'll jump into index funds and dollar cost averaging and all that fun stuff we're going to talk about in today's episode. So Andrew and I have known each other. I don't know why I'm looking at my watch, but I want to say for about 20 years.
To November of 2005.
Because that's when you started. I was counting 20 years because when I started at Home Depot, it was 2002. So like 17 years, let's call it that. We were both in our early mid-20s.
Yep.
Been a smidge, like a year older than me. You're about my age, right? You're the same age?
45.
Okay. I forgot how old I am all of a sudden.
Yeah.
I'm 42.
Aren't you 41, 42?
42. Yeah. I'll be 43 later this year. We sound like a little kid when I say that. I'll be 43 soon. And so we're, you know, a few years apart. But we were working together. I have like very fond memories of that time in my life.
Awesome. It was a great time.
Yeah. So I worked at Home Depot on the e-commerce team. And I think I actually interviewed you. Did I interview you?
Yes.
I mean, you didn't work for me, but I just mean like I was in your interview.
Yeah, you were part of the interview circle.
Yes. Yeah. And I remember you were coming from Burlington, Vermont, right?
Yes.
And you were like, didn't you snowboard also?
Yeah, I worked for Burton Snowboards.
Oh, you worked for Burton. That's why. Okay. Yeah. I was like, I remember like just picture. I was like, you were this like cool Vermont guy. But I mostly remember that you were like an amazing cyclist. We'll talk more about how amazing.
I was riding my bike a lot when I was in Burlington.
You were riding your bike a lot. I rode my bike to school today. Well, I say like I went to school with one of my kids to their school. And the secretary at our school, we were talking about something and I was like, I gotta go. I gotta hop on my bike and go home. And she started going, I want to ride my bicycle. I feel like I'm off beat on that song, but the Queen song, Bicycle. And then we were laughing about it. And so I played that song in my headphones the whole way home. And it was like a lovely bicycle ride. It felt silly while I was listening to Queen on my bicycle. Anyways, you don't really have a bicycle. I have like a bicycle. You have like crazy, cool.
I have some racing bikes.
Feather light. Yeah, like very nice, fancy bikes, which we'll
talk
about.
Lots of carbon fiber.
Yeah, I don't know what that means, but lots of something. Okay, but so this is my answer to Andrew. I always, and now I'll tell one more Andrew story, and then I'm going to make you introduce yourself and tell us more about you, Andrew. My other memory. Well, I have so many things I'll share over time. I'll slow build.
We've got 17 years of memories.
Oh, I thought you were going to say we've got 17 years to let listeners know about our history. So I was like, yeah, we're going to do. Yeah, I like your commitment I like your inside out money commitment, Andrew. You're looking ahead. So Andrew, we worked together at Home Depot back to then. I left after we worked together for a few years and
you were one cube down from me.
One cube down. One of my good friends.
Shara in the middle.
Yeah, we had Shara. We had Josh in there eventually. Yeah. We had a good run there. We played pickleball the other day with some of these people actually. One of the things that I got a lot of things I will compliment you on throughout. I'll sprinkle them throughout our various episodes, Andrew, but I don't think I knew about your passion for an interest in financial topics then. I don't think it was something we talked about.
Definitely wasn't something we talked about.
And I don't think you were as deep into it until around the time I left, actually.
Yeah, it really started when I moved to Atlanta. It was when I started getting into the personal finance space.
We'll talk more about that. But what was interesting is then when I started the podcast, you reached out And I reconnected with a number of people that were interested in that topic at the time. And you sent me your favorite book, which I have a, what book was it? It's J.L. Collins' book,
The Simple Path to Wealth. J.L. Collins, yes.
I have a confession to make.
You haven't read it yet?
No. But I want to be honest with you. I want to start this relationship out with honesty.
That's okay.
I know it's one of the most popular books. I already am like indoctrinated into everything I know is in the book. It is the
best book.
I have, the problem is it is a physical book and I love audiobooks. And so it's on my list. I'm actually like more recommitted because I can't look at your face and do this podcast and not read it. So I'm gonna do my homework and then we'll talk more about it.
Okay, great.
But it was just a really thoughtful thing that we like kind of reached out, reconnected. And you are someone who, though we can sometimes go a year without talking, we reconnect. It, like, I feel like, you know, we don't miss a beat. I remember some years you came and had Thanksgiving with my parents.
Yeah, that was the first thing. One of the most generous things you did was right when we started, I moved down here to Atlanta and I had no family here. And you graciously offered for Crystal and I to come have Thanksgiving dinner with you and your family. And I got to meet your family and it was great.
Yeah, I remember Crystal playing like, was it Sudoku or something? Her and my mom like hit it off on some game.
Yes, Sudoku.
Okay, yeah. And I think it was like, I didn't play Sudoku with my mom. And I'm like, great, my mom loves Crystal. Like, I don't even get an invite to Thanksgiving, but Crystal's always welcome. And then also more recently, one of my best connections to Andrew more recently is you got very into sourdough bread making and you were the one who gave me your starter and like really spent a lot of time. We had like a 3-hour lunch one day or coffee or something where you walked me through a lot of stuff. And then you'd like send me video. You were just super helpful. Like we would text back and forth. I'd be like, why does my bread look like? What's going wrong? Why is this doesn't look right? You just were I think I called you my bread mentor at some point.
Well, I actually thought you were going to introduce me to this podcast as your bread friend.
Yeah. Well, you're more than just a bread friend. And the great thing about bread friend is it's like on both. It's like money bread and sourdough bread.
Exactly. You know? We could definitely do an episode on the benefits of sourdough from a financial perspective.
We could. And what you could like, what financial lessons sourdough can teach you. Because I think there's something to glean from the complex. It's a science and an art. It's just, it's a bunch of things. Okay, why don't you give, I'm done with my Andrew intro. I'm probably going to pepper in some other things, but how would you like to, like, tell us about yourself?
I'll give you my elevator speech quickly. So I grew up in New Jersey. I went to school in Boston. I went to Boston College. That's where I met my wife. We both were at BC. I then, after going to BC, I got an economics degree, and then I was always interested in technology, and I went into the tech field, and that's how I got into e-commerce. I moved to Burlington, worked for Burton Snowboards as a web developer, and then I worked at Gardner Supply, gardners.com, as a web developer as well. And so that was the first 5 years in Vermont, and then Home Depot recruited me down to Atlanta. I joined Home Depot, and that's where I got to meet you, and we worked on the e-commerce team together, and then
we were the e-commerce team for a while.
Yeah, it was a really small
team. It was a small team. There were like six of us.
Yes.
And we ran a pretty badass e-commerce team at the time, I think, back in the early 2000s.
Yes. Well before Omnichannel ever existed. It was a sub $500 million business at the time. You think about how big Home Depot's e-commerce business has become. It's pretty incredible. And so then the job at Home Depot was my transition from technology onto the business side, and did a bunch of different other roles on the business side with supply chain, a little bit of sourcing work. And then I joined Carter's. And so currently I work at Carter's in Oshkosh. I've been there for 10 years and I currently manage the international business for them outside of North America.
And you have kids?
I've got a family. So Kristen and I, we're a little later in the game on having children, but we've got two great kids. My daughter, Brielle, is 9 and my son, Brendan, is 6.
Nice. Is that purposeful, the two B names?
Yeah, maybe a little bit.
A for Andrew, BB, and then C.
Yeah, so we were team ABC when Brielle was first born. And then when Brendan was born, we became AB squared C.
I'm surprised you didn't name him with a D, so you could be like ABCD.
It was contemplated, but...
Okay, well, I think we will learn more about you. Hold on a second. Wait, you left out one thing. You have gotten, you took a hiatus for a while, right? Fatherhood, busy job. You cycled when you first came to Atlanta.
Yeah, so when I was a cyclist in Vermont, did a lot of racing up there, and then retired from cycling when I joined Home Depot. and then took a long hiatus from riding my bike. And then I was super busy with Carter's and managing the international business.
You traveled a lot.
Traveled a lot. Yeah, 30 plus countries a year. We can get into that at some point. And then COVID hit and COVID grounded me. And so in May of 2020,
it literally grounded you.
Literally grounded me. Yeah, I couldn't fly anymore. And so I had a lot of, you know, a lot of free time with not having to travel. So I hadn't touched my bike in 6 or 7 years. And I picked it up in June of 2020, and have started riding a lot and racing again. So it's been a lot of fun.
Okay, you're a humble guy, Andrew. When you say picked it up again and started racing, didn't you win something that's kind of a big deal this past year? Just tell us.
I won 3 national championships last summer.
So in your age group, you're like the fastest person in the U.S.?
Yeah, so I won the Masters road race, which is in my age group, 45 to 49. And then I won the time trial in the same age category. And then I won the Grand Fondo National Championship across all age groups.
So no other 45 to 49 year old man in the U.S. has beat you in this past year. Maybe someday someone will.
In that race, in those specific races, no.
Well, they would show up if they thought they could beat you. So, okay. Well, that's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. I'm pretty impressed. You have like a special jersey you get to wear. And
yep.
I wouldn't recognize it, but all the other cyclists in Atlanta, when they see the jersey, they're like, oh, he's a national champion.
Yeah. So I get a Stars and Stripes jersey that I wear. I just got a custom one created for my team that came in last week. So I've started wearing that this week, which is always, it's fun. It's cool.
And sometimes you ride your bike from where, well, it doesn't even matter where, because you don't need to know the neighborhoods in Atlanta, but how many miles to work?
When we started going back into the office, I did most of my training in the morning. And so I didn't want to give that up. And I decided, let's start trying to ride my bike to work. And I started doing that about 18 months ago. And I love it. And so Tuesday, we're in the office 3 days a week now. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, I ride my bike from East Cobb into Phipps Tower in Buckhead. If I straight shot it, it's about 14 miles, but I typically do a longer loop to just get some more mileage in. So I leave.
You're the only one extending your commute into work.
Yeah, I typically will leave. This morning I left at 5:15 and got a couple hours in on the way to work, and then got a full day in at work and then rode home.
Okay, we can't share all of the good Andrew stories on the first episode, but in a future episode, remind me that we're going to share your whole office setup of like how you deal with clothes and all your stuff, because I'm fascinated. We talked about this that day we met to have you be my sourdough coach and mentor, but I love it. It's fascinating, logistics and like the efficiency of this plan you've set up and your whole laundry system. The whole thing's great.
Yeah, we can. I mean, it kind of ties into personal finance, because me not taking my car to work every day, I ended up selling my Tesla and buying some bikes because I just wasn't driving it.
And cyclists in your league, or I don't know what you would call it, in the echelon you compete in, you need a nice bike. You're not riding on the, you know, $700 bike that I own.
No.
I don't even think my bike costs $700, $300 bike that I own. Yes. So I thought it was a really cool trade-off on just tied to your values and intentions of you had a Tesla, loved it, and at some point said, hey, I'm not even driving anymore. And I care more about riding my bike and
right.
Investing in a good bike. Okay. We'll talk more about that in another topic. I am excited to jump into this topic. And I will say, when I started, Andrew and I knew we were going to do this, but we didn't know this would be our first topic. And I said to Andrew, I'm like, what are you like most passionate about in the finance space? Let's start there. And this is what you chose.
This is my response.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And I'm also passionate about it, because as I have said many, 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 many times on Friends on Fire, my number one biggest financial regret in life is not knowing what Andrew, you could say, and I'll chime in, but what Andrew is about to tell you, right? And I'm sometimes like, Andrew, how do we not discuss this?
I know.
When we worked
the number
together
of times
you
went
Depot.
To lunch at Home Depot, the number yeah. of times, and we just never talked about it.
Well, it's kind of back to my theory that a lot of people don't talk about money. They're not comfortable. So you didn't yeah. know that I was a safe person to discuss money with.
Right.
I don't even know if I knew it then. My biggest regret is I was overwhelmed by the options of where to put my money. I left a lot of money sitting in cash. I spent a decade in my 30s seeking a financial planner and trying various paths out for that. And it took me a while to realize not only did I not need a financial planner, I was better off without one and I could do it myself for better and cheaper. And we'll get into why.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to kick us off?
Yeah. Why don't we start with index funds and talk a little bit about the history of them. So John Bogle is referred to as the father of the modern index fund. He came up with this concept and started the Vanguard Group. 1974, I think, is when they started. And his whole premise was that you want to buy the whole market, right? You don't want to, you back then people were picking and choosing stocks. And his theory was that the fees matter and that it's about the total return of the market and that you want to own the market. You don't want to own the individual stocks. And it's a way of, there's no better way to be diversified than owning the market.
It's pretty impressive, Andrew, that that was his theory when the company he founded made money off fees.
Yes.
So it's very altruistic of him to, because he had Vanguard before he started this, or were they?
No, he started Vanguard with this specific purpose.
Okay.
To say, Vanguard is going to be different. We are going to be index. We're going to be an index fund company. And he even set up the structure of Vanguard to be completely different. What's very different about Vanguard is that they're not accountable to shareholders. It's owned by the investors. And so the fees that Vanguard charge, it's almost like a nonprofit, right? The fees that Vanguard charges are to support the function of the company. If there's excess profit made, it goes back to the shareholder. There are no shareholders. Everybody who owns a piece of Vanguard is an owner of the company. Essentially, you own a share of the fund and the funds own a share of Vanguard, the company. And we're talking about, I mean, probably the most famous one that Vanguard has is VTSAX. And you'll hear people talk about VTSAX all the time in the personal finance community. VTSAX is the fund that is the total U.S. domestic stock market. Basically, every single company that's listed, it's 3,900 companies are all part of VTSAX. And it's massive. They have $1.2 trillion in that fund. So VTSAX is a great fund.
Is it what you were primarily personally invested in?
That is where 100% of my investable assets are in, that are outside of the company mandated stuff like the company 401k, where you only have a set. Now, some people offer Vanguard funds. My company doesn't, but for wherever I can, I put the money into VTSAX.
And then I assume wherever you can't, you find the closest equivalent.
Correct. So like in the Carter's 401k fund, there's an S&P 500 fund. And so I have 100% of the 401k in the S&P 500 fund there. With Vanguard, I actually started with their S&P 500 one for like maybe just a couple months. I hadn't heard about VTSAX. And then as soon as I'd heard about VTSAX, then I started putting everything into that fund.
I am very often jealous of, I don't know if jealous is the right word, but I don't use Vanguard. And it's really only because I historically had already had a bunch of things with Fidelity. And so when I did start to buy things, I just had so much there. It's like a pain to move.
Yeah.
And we often will tell people, I don't know if you agree, but that look, in the end, if you're already with a certain brokerage, like it's fine. You can do most of what you want to do. But I will say, anytime someone is new to investing and hasn't yet opened a brokerage account, I will always say, like, I would start with Vanguard based on everything I hear from everybody else. Like, if I were starting all over again, I'd go with Vanguard.
Yeah. I was a little late to Vanguard. I actually had a family member who worked at a mutual fund company. And so I actually started investing in just straight mutual funds because I wasn't being charged a sales charge because I had a family member there. And then once I started learning more about Vanguard, I opened an account with Vanguard in 2012 was when I first started. So I've been with them a little over 10 years. You know, and then I started reading Jack Bogle's book, The Little Book of Common Sense Investing. And that is a fantastic read. It's a little on the dry side, I'll warn you, but it is just, it's a fascinating read around his approach to the market, the research that has been done, and he just lays the case for why index investing is so powerful and the benefits of it.
Speaking of that, since you mentioned it's a little bit on the dry side, I don't actually, I mean, it's been on my reading list also, along with The Simple Path to Wealth that we have already admitted I have never read. I should have said this in the beginning too. Andrew, when did you start your blog?
I bought andrewknight.com in 1996.
Did you start blogging on it then though?
I did not start blogging on it. Oh, no, 98. I was a junior in college. Yeah, 1998 is when I started it. And it's gone through a bunch of different iterations. It wasn't really a blog per se. It was more of like a homepage for my life.
Like your resume?
I had my resume on at one point.
I remember when that was cool. I also bought my own name as a domain and had my resume on it when I was in college. I built it in a web design class in Georgia.
You probably used FrontPage or something like that.
Yeah, I did use FrontPage. Good memory.
I'd use it for posting all of a lot of pictures that I would take and all of that stuff. You know, I was a web developer, right? That was my job. So I used it a little bit as a playground as well. I then started when I started getting into personal finance back in 2008, 2010. I then started writing some blog posts about personal finance specifically. And so I've done a couple. I did a couple book review posts, but last couple of years I have not posted much. But I'd like to at some point get more into it and post some things.
The reason I mentioned it is, and we'll put a link in the show notes to it, is that you did write a blog post or a book review of The Little Book of Common Sense Investing by John Bogle. Mm-hmm. And why don't you like share some of the highlights of that book? Because I know you said it's dry, so we'll save everybody the time and you can get the Andrew Cliff Notes version.
Right. So one of my favorite quotes in the book is, "The greatest enemies of the equity investor are expenses and emotions." Nothing sums up the power of index investing with VTSAX, along with dollar cost averaging, that we'll get into about why it's such a powerful tool on the emotional side. But those two together are just a really powerful combination for growing your portfolio and growing wealth. So, you know, I think some of the key messages in the book are the total returns of the market, the total returns for the investor are the returns of the market minus expenses, fees, and transaction costs. You know, his argument is that the regular investor doesn't get their fair share of returns of the market because they're having to pay fees and transaction costs. And so that's a big point of the book. And I think sometimes people forget, like with the market, there's somebody always on the other side of the transaction, right? So when you're selling a stock, someone thinks that it's a good idea to buy the stock. At the end of the day, the total returns for all investors is the total returns of the market minus the fees and transaction costs. And like when you think about it like that, you see how, you know, most financial wealth management companies charge 1%. It's significant, whereas, you know, Vanguard will charge 0.03%. And one thing I'll say also with Vanguard is so many companies have now followed the Vanguard model because they've seen how successful Vanguard has become with it. So whether it's much less important today, like Fidelity offers almost the exact same funds as Vanguard with the same expense ratios or even lower expenses.
Yeah, they launched zero. They're trying to like undercut Vanguard. I mean, Vanguard barely charges anything in the first place, but yes, they've come in. And like when we were at Home Depot, remember Lowe's? Their strategy was to watch what we did, then do it better. But like, let us innovate. And I say us, like we still work there, but it's not a bad strategy. But to your point, yes, like don't get hung up on, oh, I'm not with Vanguard. You could do this anywhere.
So another point that Bogle makes is just about the emotional piece. You know, typical retail investors, they buy high and they sell low, right? It's just human nature, right? People are fearful. And we've seen it time and time again throughout the different ups and downs of the market that it's very hard to follow that buy and hold strategy because of human nature and emotions. And so he kind of specifically addresses that head on to say time in the market is the most important thing, and that the ups and downs, you've got to be willing to weather those storms. Leaving the market when it's low is the absolute worst thing that you can do. Now, you got to make sure your timing is right and that you don't need those funds if you're, you know, late in your retirement or close to retirement. But that's where the benefits of youth are, where, you know, if you don't need these funds for 30, 40 years on that time horizon, there's really no need to pay attention to the ups and downs. You know, and that kind of leads into dollar cost averaging and kind of why I believe the combination of the two is so important.
So why don't you define what dollar cost averaging is for people?
When you want to put money into the market, people refer to, there are two options. You can either lump sum, which is, hey, I want to take $10,000 and I want to put it in all today. Or you want a dollar cost average, which is I want to spread it out. And rather than putting $10,000 in one day, you're going to put $1,000 in every week for the next 10 weeks. What I found so interesting about dollar cost average, if you do the math, purely math, you look at the statistics, every single math exercise, and which is back tested things, has said lump sum's the way. And it's because my earlier point of time in the market is the most important thing. And so if you lump sum it, you are by definition, you are getting more time in the market. And so if you look at it from a purely mathematical perspective, the experts would say you should always lump sum your investments. But this comes back to like the same concept around like whether you should pay off your mortgage or not, right? The math says that you shouldn't pay off your mortgage, that you can get better returns in the market. So why pay off your 5% interest mortgage when you can get 7% in the market? Well, it's a little bit of human nature, right? And the way that people approach their finances is emotions, and emotions come into it in psychology. And so when I started reading more into dollar cost averaging and I started doing it, what I was so shocked at is what it did for me from an emotional perspective and the psychology. After doing it for, you know, a few, probably it was like 6 months or so, I realized I now no longer care what the market is doing, because I'm actually, if the market is up, great, the total portfolio balance is up. But what happens if the market is down? Well, if I'm dollar cost averaging and I'm putting money continually into the market, I now am actually happy the market is down, because I'm now buying at a lower share price and I'm getting more shares. And so that's where I see the huge potential of dollar cost averaging and why, even though the math says, and like this is where I come out on a lot of things with personal finances, is I don't necessarily agree with the math, because I believe that psychology and human nature is so much of a bigger part of personal finance than actually the numbers. I would actually argue it's 80% human nature and it's 20% the numbers. Yeah, you got to have the fundamentals right, right? Like yes. paying 25% on a high interest credit card. Yeah, that's not smart. But
spend less than you make.
Right.
You got to get the basics down.
Yes. All of these fund companies, it's super easy to set up. Vanguard actually offers super flexibility. You can put stuff in on the first of the month, the 15th of the month. You can do both. You can do every 2 weeks. I've got it set up where every 2 weeks I'm putting money into the market. I've been doing that since the beginning of Vanguard.
So the other thing, just to double click on your psychology point, Andrew, which you know I agree, and that's the whole spirit of why this is called Inside Out Money, yep. Right? Is it our mindset and the psychology of our financial decisions is 80 to 90% of your success in improving your personal finances. 10% of it's some technical skills that you can yep. learn and that we'll help teach you. Right. But one of the things that I love about dollar cost averaging, and I think it's part of what you were getting at, is trying to time the market, I would say to the average person, almost impossible, like literally impossible. The odds are against you. You might get lucky. But even to somebody who is more educated and follows things more closely and is researching things and all of that, there's just a level of decision fatigue and stressing yourself out and mentally beating yourself up over, well, it's like gambling. You're going to have a win sometimes. It literally is gambling in many ways. You can certainly educate yourself and become a better gambler, but it's still gambling. There's just, to me, the dollar cost averaging approach, it removes the decision fatigue. And you simplify
exactly
your approach. And I think that is so powerful. And that's what I was like missing when I was younger. I was missing the index funds and I was missing the timing. And I give another example of dollar cost averaging that I think is helpful, because you were going down the path of ongoing money that you earn and that you continue to put into the market. You're not like saving up loads of money to say, oh, I'm going to wait for a recession's coming. I'm going to wait for the market to dip. You're putting in money every other week, mm-hmm. every month, yep. as you
every 2 weeks.
Yeah, every 2 weeks. And I do the same thing. But there also are scenarios. So I'll give you an example. When I left and early retired about a year ago, I had to cash out my 401k to transfer it. Part of the rollover process is you're actually selling the investments with T. Rowe Price that my company used to manage my 401k. It had very limited amount of selections from you invest in, higher fees. And I was like, I want to get it out of that. And I didn't get to choose the exact day it sold and when the check finally arrived to me. So there was like a little bit of wonkiness in how the market, I was not happy in how the market performed in that small period of time. So I was really in my head about how to reinvest it because I had kind of lost some money in that time period. And I was like, when do I go back in? For me, I dollar cost averaged it. I was like, you know what? I don't know if the markets, I'm going to be frustrated if a month in, I dollar cost averaged a large lump sum of money where in, I think you gave an early example like this, where I took a big sum of money, let's call it $100,000 for easy numbers. And I said, okay, I'm not going to dump $100,000 into rebuying like a version of VTSAX that's with Fidelity. I'm not going to buy that all today. Because what if the market drops in 2 weeks? Then I'm going to be like, dang, that's frustrating. Now, what if, and then what if it goes up? Who knows? I don't know when we're going to hit the bottom. I don't know what's going on. And so I decided I'm going to buy, I can't remember exactly what I did, but I basically, it was a bigger sum of money. But again, using the $100,000 example, I said, okay, every week I'm going to buy $10,000. So I didn't want to sit on that cash for too long and keep it out of the market. But I said, I can buy it over 3 months. Yeah, it's been in the market for 20 years. What's 3 months of me averaging my way back into the market? And every now and then, if I felt like things were a little like there was a bad week, I might put a little extra in, but a little bit, right? I'm layering in a little bit of gut to my decision to dollar cost average it. And it took the decision fatigue. I just kind of picked, there's no perfect time period. I could have done it over 6 months. I could have done it over a month. But just the idea of you want to slow and evenly drip that money back into the market if you're sitting on a lump sum. I just think, like you said, the concept of index funds and then the concept of when and how you buy index funds, which is dollar cost averaging, those two things, they might seem too simple and too boring to some people in a way who think, oh, I need to learn about the market and figure out which companies to buy and listen to people's earnings calls and all that. You don't need to. And there's a massive amount of research that actually, including from really intelligent guidance from people like Warren Buffett and Bogle, that you cannot, like owning a slice of the market will always, historically, has always outperformed individual fund managers' selections.
Yeah, I have this debate with friends and family when I tell people, wait, you're 100% in just index funds. You don't have any individual stocks. And my argument is always, you've got some of the smartest people in the world in the finance industry, right? All Ivy League MBAs, right? These people are brilliant. You're telling me that you think that you can outperform them, that your knowledge of the market is these people, this is all they do all day long, is they are looking at companies and trying to pick options and stocks, right, for their investments, and you think that you can outperform them, and you're, it's almost like you think you can beat Tiger Woods on the golf course,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, maybe you
I like
can.
Using the sports analogies,
yeah,
right?
And the odds are like, yes, there's a chance that he, I was gonna say fumble, that's not the right golf reference, but you know what I mean, that he like messes something up,
shanks his drive,
he, exactly. I have no idea what you mean, but yes, that he shanks his drive. And then I get lucky, right? And get a hole in one. Like, yes, the odds are one in a million, but could happen. But most likely that will not be what happens.
It's interesting you say the word luck, right? A lot of people mistake luck for skill when it comes to stock picking. And I have this debate a lot with family members who want to try and beat the market. I don't care about beating the market. I don't want to beat the market. And I don't want to not perform against the market. I want to be at the market.
Yeah.
Right? Because if you think about it, if you're going to beat the market, someone's going to be on the other side of that transaction, not meeting the market. The whole premise of the index fund is, I just want to get the market returns. And if you look at historicals, what the market has produced over the last 40, 50, 60 years, it's a really powerful wealth builder.
For anyone who hears that and thinks, but I want to beat the market, I don't want the average, don't think of it as the average, because that's what I'm trying to say is historically, all research shows you can't beat the average. It's not, it's like, what do they say in casinos? Like the house rules? Is that what,
yeah,
what is it? Right. The house rules, right? The market rules.
The house always wins.
Yeah, the house always wins. Thank you. You're going to have to fill in all sports and gambling, et cetera, references for me, Andrew. The house always wins, right? The average of the market always outperforms. And that fund manager example you gave, like, yes, they're professional. They still can't beat the market historically. Some of them can, but the odds are they won't.
That's a great point. I like using like my own company as an example. I am extremely knowledgeable about the inner workings at my company. And when we post our quarterly earnings, most of the time I get it wrong in terms of how the market's going to respond.
And you work there.
And I work there. And I know all the ins and outs of what's going on. And I still can't predict what the market is going to do. And I love using that example to say, you know, I'm an extremely knowledgeable person about the performance of my company, and I still can't predict which way the market's going to react sometimes.
I'm the same way. And every time I would get stock grants and have to choose whether I would sell them or hold on to them, like buy or hold, basically, I had the same thing. I'm like, that's a freaking crapshoot, you know? But I ultimately, I'm like, I don't want to own, this is a different point than you're making, but I don't want to own a bunch of any one stock. So usually I would just sell upon grant and then put it into the market. Because I'm already fully invested in working for this company in addition to, you know, having.
Yeah, that's great approach.
Which is an extra tip for folks who do get stock grants, that most of the time, I don't know if your advice would be the same, Andrew, but I would always say when you get stock grants of your company's stock, unless you're in like a unique startup, you're going to go rich situation, when it's an established company, you sell it and you put it into the market.
Yep.
It's a diversification strategy too. Of they're your employer. And you want, you know, let's say you lose your job and the company's not doing, now you've just lost your stock, you've lost the value of stock and you've lost your paycheck and you had a lot tied up in one company. I'm getting off track here. We already talked about one of the myths of index funds, which I think is that some people think it's only for passive investors. And many people, I think, especially when they have some friend or family member or something that works for a financial planner or that works for a brokerage firm or something, they're convinced by somebody that that person can manage their money better by more actively picking not necessarily individual stocks, but specific mutual funds or ETFs or other things. And that's just not true. I don't want to say like true or false, but research does not support that that is true.
There's a lot of conflict of interest within the financial community, right? People are selling things that they have an incentive to sell. I think there's a place for fee-only financial planners, right? If I'm looking at a financial planner, it's always going to be a fee-only one. And I think the big part, you know, the benefit of working with someone like that is that they help stop the emotional piece, right? They can be a sounding board. So when the market drops 1,000 points and you call them up and they'll calm you down, right? Like, I think that's the benefit. Also, like, coming back to the index approach is super boring, right? But it's also super easy, right? And you don't necessarily need a ton of guidance on the strategy. It's a very boring, simple, I refer to it as the tortoise approach, right? Nothing gets more boring than just putting your money in an index fund.
And it's a DIY approach. It's because it's boring and simple, you can do it yourself. And yes, I do agree. I'm not a fan of financial planners that charge a percentage, like the 1% you were talking about earlier. But there's times when a fee-only financial planner that's charging you hourly, they have no disincentives to sell you things you shouldn't own. And they're not trying to sell you whole life insurance, things like that, because they make a crazy commission on them. I mean, even a financial planner, they're promoting often funds that have bigger fees for their firm, right? And so there's a lot of incentives that are lined up to them and not to you. And they're often hidden, so you wouldn't see them.
Yeah. So two things that some people also will sometimes mention when it comes to Vanguard and VTSAX is maybe criticisms a little bit. The first is that, well, you don't have any international exposure if you're in VTSAX. It's only the US domestic market. And yes, Vanguard offers some international funds. They have slightly higher expense ratios. But my response to that is always, you look at the companies who are in the US market and they all have massive international businesses. I manage an international business for a domestic company that's listed on the New York Stock Exchange, right? And you know, you look at Apple, you look at Google, like all of them have massive international businesses. So you are, while it is the domestic stock market, you still have tons of exposure to the international markets. And then the second criticism, and this is more general for index funds than just Vanguard specifically, but I've been said, well, what if everybody index funds? What if everybody just puts their money in the index fund? Well, that's an interesting question, right? What would happen, right? My response to it is always, there's always going to be a segment of the population that is going to be chasing higher returns. And so if you think about the financial analysts serve a very important purpose. They hold public companies accountable. They hold boards accountable. And so there is a place for the I mean, you don't want the financial industry just simply to go away and everybody's just putting their money in index funds. So there's going to be a place for that. Some of the criticism has been over the years as index funds have become much more popular for investors that Vanguard is pretty much the number one shareholder in almost every single public company now at this point. So if you look at the proxy statements, Vanguard or BlackRock is typically at the top of the list for every single public company. But there's always, you know, Wall Street is always going to be chasing. It's why, you know, I think your casino example is good. There's always people who are going to think they can beat the market and they can find the edge. Because essentially beating the market is saying, I think I can find an edge. I think I can find undervalued companies and I can invest in them and I can make a better return than what the market is going to deliver.
Warren Buffett is famous for his advice, which is, again, very similar to Bogle, but it's not founded in greed. It's founded in, and I'm not saying, I mean, he's got a lot of money, so I'm not.
Greatest investor of all time.
But his thing, your tortoise comment, he believed in slow and steady compound growth. And one of his original partners didn't. And I can't remember his name, but I was just reading about him in a book.
His book is great too, by the way. His by...
Which book?
The Snowball. Warren Buffett and the Business of Life. Yeah. I mean, that's basically compound interest, right? Right there,
yeah.
The Snowball. But, you know, Buffett's famous for the shareholder letter in 2013 when he says, he outlines what's in his will. In his will, he says to his wife, put 90% of the assets into an index fund and put 10% into government bonds and call it a day. So the greatest investor of all time is telling his wife in his will to put 90% into index funds.
Yeah.
I mean, is there anything more powerful? Is there any advice that's more powerful than that?
Said a different way, I was reading a book called The Psychology of Money recently, which is a great book.
How was that? Is that good?
It's good. I'm almost done with it. One point, he kind of half in jest says, like, the best investment advice I could give is, like, shut up and wait, right? It's don't be so caught up. All the things we've been talking about, like, just sit there and be patient and wait. Like, buy the index funds, let them sit.
Patience. It comes back to being the tortoise, right?
And it's early and often, right? Like, that's, again, back to my regret. When I was in my 20s, let me tell you how much disposable income I had that I could have been putting. I would have 3 to 4 times as much money as I have now had I put the extra money I had back then, not left it sitting. It pains me to talk about. I'm still incredibly privileged and thankful for what I have. But sometimes when I really go down the rabbit hole of like doing the math, I'm like, wow. Now, the only thing I can do is tell every other 20-year-old, or no matter what age you are, it's never too late. Start now. Go put $20 in if that's all you have, right? Start and then continue to build and put sock away. We talk about dollar cost averaging, but I will say, if you're slowly just saving money and you have bits and pieces you're able to save here, throw them into your account every time you can.
Your 401k at work is a dollar cost average.
Yeah.
It's you putting a percentage of your paycheck
every two weeks.
You're dollar cost averaging. And so everybody who has access to a 401k or some type of retirement fund at work has the ability to dollar cost average. And most companies offer some type of index fund. So a lot of them are just the S&P 500. S&P 500 tracks VTSAX very closely, right? So it's the top 500 where VTSAX is a little bit more diversified. But you can, if you have access to a 401k and an S&P 500 fund, you can start this today.
Okay, Andrew, is there anything else that you want to share with people on this topic that we didn't cover?
Start early and often. Be patient. Don't chase the market. Time in the market is what matters. Not trying to time the market. Don't chase the returns. Be satisfied with making the market returns. Take the tortoise approach. Slow and steady.
Don't get freaked out when we have a recession and the market goes down. When it was 2008, all the people who sold their money, put more money in. You're getting everything at a discount.
Everything at a discount.
You really have to put blinders on and you have to have faith in the system.
Don't watch CNBC.
Don't read the news.
Don't watch Mad Money.
Don't listen to your uncle who
right
knows a lot about money and tells you you should sell everything.
I mean, really, the strategies are so simple. And it's almost like, is it really this simple? Is it really this? It's almost like, what's the trick? I would say, like, when I discovered the dollar cost averaging, it was so liberating for me. I just had the type of personality that I was just really focused on the ups and downs of day to day. And it freaked me out. I love your comment about decision fatigue. Like, when do I put it in? When do I not put it in?
Today to day?
Oh. It's right. It's just so like it was all it became all encompassing for me before I was dollar cost averaging. And as soon as I dollar cost, it was almost like, wow, that's the unlock. It was liberating. It was such an incredible feeling for me to say, okay, all of what I was experiencing before goes away. And I have one strategy, one approach. I don't have to think about it. It takes zero mental processing, right? There's a lot more going on in my head to worry about than what's going on with the market and what the right investment strategy approach is. And so it's really the secret to everything for me.
Yeah, I love it. Okay, I have two closing questions for you.
Yeah.
One, and this will just be a starter because I actually want to do a future episode with you on this. Do your kids own any index funds? Like, have you opened any custodial accounts for them? Are they dollar cost averaging yet?
Well, kind of. The day they were both born, I opened 529 accounts. And I know you lump summed your 529s.
Towards the end, not in the beginning. In the beginning, I slowly put money in.
Yeah. And so I've got a dollar cost average set up for them in their 529. Every single month since the month they were born, I've put money into their 529 account. And so they don't have anything in their own name. Although actually, no, technically the 529
they're
is
in
their
name.
Yeah, it's in their name. They don't have anything outside of the 529, but I will at some point. I don't know. How old do your kids?
You can
open a banking account?
No, well, you can open a custodial account with them now in Vanguard.
Okay.
And it actually, it's really good for estate planning purposes, but it's also in their name. So from a tax estate. Anyways, I want to do a whole episode on custodial accounts and other things you should do to set your kids up for success financially. I think it'd be a fun episode for us specifically. Yep. Okay. Second question. It's a quick one. If we've talked about a number of books here today, even, and you're a pretty well-read guy, if there's one financial book that you could recommend for people who, if they could only read one book and they're only going to read one book, what's probably your number one recommendation? And is it the book that you sent me and I haven't read?
Yes, The Simple Path to Wealth. Yeah.
Okay, now I'm even more motivated to read it.
I used to give Dave Ramsey's Total Money Makeover as a wedding present to people. And we actually should probably do a Dave Ramsey episode at some point to just talk about that. Because I know you did an episode already on that.
I don't think we did a whole Dave Ramsey episode. Like, a lot of people have like whole episodes bashing Dave Ramsey. I never really followed him closely enough to bash him.
So that's actually how I got into it. That's how I got into personal finance.
I only knew that from reading it on your blog.
I got into it when I moved to Atlanta and he was on WSB radio.
Which is why I don't believe in most of the things that Dave Ramsey believes in. And he's like a pretty judgmental person in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And he's got a kind of shaming approach to people with money, which I'm not mm-hmm. a fan of. But the one thing I will give him credit for, and I'm sure there's other things he has deserved some credit for, is he popularized this topic and motivated people like you and mm-hmm. many others.
Yeah.
To improve their finances. So even people like, I love Justin and Haley at the Price Avocado Toast, which is the name of a podcast. And they do not like Dave Ramsey at all. They have whole episodes. If you want to hear good episodes of like people ranting about Dave Ramsey, they've got some. But they still wouldn't have gotten into improving their personal finances without having discovered him. And so he's been mainstream enough and he's gotten the word out and motivated a lot of people to make some really positive changes in their lives financially. But anyway, so you don't give that book out anymore, was your point?
I don't give that one out. I now give The Simple Path to Wealth.
I love that you give that as a wedding present. I was going to kind of make fun of you and be like, wait, did you come to my wedding? And did you give me, how come you didn't give me a financial book? Because that's about the age I could have used a slap upside the head about what to do.
Well, the reason I do it is imagine, like, I was like, I wish someone would have given me that
book. Yeah.
Like imagine if you had gotten Simple Path to Wealth as you would, basically, I mean, The Simple Path to Wealth, I'll summarize it. It's talking about a lot of what we talked about here with index funds and, you know, the basics of personal finance. He just lays it out in a very simple, easy to way to understand it. I don't know. The premise is actually, it was started by him writing letters to his daughter. And I think about that a lot. Like, it's like, I started writing some of the stuff on my blog is like, hey, I wanted to have a record for my kids, right? To say, hey, here's how I think about things. I started that like independently of reading about Simple Path to Wealth and what he did, but he literally started it as a series of letters that he was writing to his daughter to help her on her path to financial independence. And then he started turning it into a blog. And then he basically the book is a summary of blog articles that he wrote.
Wow, that's so cool. That is, I agree. That's a very kind of special angle.
I want to clarify. It's not the only.
I was just going to ask you. I was literally, I didn't mean to put you on the spot and I didn't want it. Like, you're a pretty generous guy, Andrew. I was like, is that the only thing? Or do you like combine that with a gift card or like.
There's an envelope in there.
Okay.
Yes.
I like it. To get you started and like a login to your Vanguard account. You should, if only you could start an account for someone, like, I'm giving you money, but it's in your, there should be an easier way to gift stocks to people. Is there?
Yeah, it's called cash.
But so many people would take that cash and like, it's gone before you know it. I wish the same way you could gift like a hotel gift card to somebody where it's like, you have to use this with Delta or you have to use this at Amazon. Wouldn't it be? I feel like these brokers.
I don't know if Vanguard offers gift cards or not.
I mean, I'm just saying.
If they don't, we could suggest
it. You should get on that. So I'd like credit for that idea. Brokerage gift cards. And then Andrew will add them to his wedding present lineup. Okay. I love that you give that as a wedding present. I might steal that idea. Except I've frequently said a lot, nobody I know is ever getting married. I don't know if it's our age.
I have two people on my team that are getting married.
And are you invited?
In the next 2 weeks.
Are you invited?
Yes.
I want to go to a wedding.
Unfortunately, I can't go.
I want to go to a wedding. Nobody, it's not that I don't get invited. Like, nobody I know is getting married anymore. And I always joke, I'm like, I know more people getting divorced lately than married.
For my business, we need people to get married and we need people to have kids.
We need people to have kids and want to buy cute clothes for their kids.
Correct.
Yes. Okay. Andrew, it has been a pleasure. I'm excited to do more of these with you. I hope you'll come back and continue to do.
Yeah, this was great. This is my first podcast ever. So I've never done one before. No.
I'm glad I got to be a part of it. And I've got some homework. I'm going to read the book, the wedding present book.
Okay.
Thank you so much for listening. I know your time is limited and valuable, and we appreciate you spending some of it with us. If you've enjoyed today's episode, please give us a written review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. We truly appreciate it. We also encourage you to share this episode with a friend or family member to encourage ongoing discussions about money and investing. You can also subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have any thoughts or questions, we'd love to hear from you, and you can leave us a voicemail or text us at 404-981-3370 or hit us up on Instagram. I feel like we should come up with some sort of like funny thing we say in the way we say goodbye. I tried to do this to Greg. I'll be very honest. I tried to be like, inside out, see you later. And he was like, no, that's not.
No, that's a little corny.
So I think we might just have to say bye.
Or thanks, Maggie.
Thanks, Andrew. Bye.
Bye.